York. You're listening to KPFT 90.1 FM. Stay tuned for Arab Voices. Guest on hold. We want to stay tuned and give you the phone number early today. We're going to be going to our guest right after the news. That phone number is 713-526-5738. I don't think we're having much luck with that CD, so we're going to have to play something else. Let's give that a try instead. Gotta love technology sometimes. Here we go. A different track. Hopefully this one will work for you. Good evening and welcome to the Arab Voices on KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston, 89.5 FM in Galveston, and kpft.org on the World Wide Web. This is Saeed, producer and host of Arab Voices, along with my co-host Mark. Our guest tonight will be Kathleen Christison, a freelance writer who worked as a political analyst with the CIA for 16 years, dealing with the Middle East for 8 years. We will discuss with her the latest developments in the Middle East and the U.S. policy towards it. We will also take your calls live, so please make a note of the phone number. It is 713-526-5738. That's 713-526-KPFT. But first, let's update you on a couple of local announcements.
Well, first I want to apologize for the, I guess it was a piece of Arab sand that was in the CD player. We'll try and get that fixed for you before we get any more music on the air. The community calendar, we only keep it short tonight. The open election for the Board of Directors of the Arab American Cultural and Community Center, scheduled for last Saturday, has been postponed. The new deadline for submission of candidate names is December 31st. The election date will be set sometime in January. The nominees who already submitted their names for this election will be automatically entered for nomination in the upcoming election. A candidate must be at least 25 years of age, a citizen or permanent resident of the U.S., in good standing in the community, and of good moral character with no criminal record. The candidate must have been a regular ACC member in good standing for at least 1 year since January 1998, and must be a paid ACC member at the time of election in January. For more information or to nominate yourself, contact the ACC at 832-351-3366.
And the ACC is also offering a variety of free health screenings to the Houston community at large. The ACC Medical Clinic is open on Sundays from 2 p.m. to 4 p.m. Different doctors with different expertise are providing this free service. To make an appointment or for more information, call 832-351-3366. And now we're going to update you on the latest news. News that you did not hear anywhere else, as the whole world was busy watching TV and listening to the radios trying to follow what happened to Saddam Hussein. There has been almost nothing reported in the mainstream media about the situation overseas except what happened to Saddam Hussein, which is simple. Everybody knows it. He's been captured. But there has been atrocities taking place on the ground, mainly in the Palestinian occupied territories, intentionally intensified by Sharon and his government, because they simply knew that the whole world is not watching and that the whole world does not know what's going on there. But we are going to update you on the details of these daily atrocities.
The Israeli occupation army invaded the Balata refugee camp near Nablus yesterday in the West Bank under a barrage of heavy gunfire and supported by combat helicopters, then imposed a tight military curfew on the camp. During this terrorist act, the occupiers shot and wounded 17 Palestinians, including Noor Amran, a 15-year-old child who was pronounced clinically dead late last night. Noor was shot in the head by an Israeli occupation soldier. The Israeli occupation army also conducted a house-to-house search, moving from one house to another through by blowing holes in the walls, which caused large structural damage in the selected houses. The occupation forces used tear gas, which caused several Palestinians to be hospitalized after suffocating from the gas. And as if firing at Palestinians was not enough, the Israeli occupation army used stun grenades, terrorizing hundreds of Palestinians while they were asleep. They also invaded the towns of Hawera and Jenin, firing heavy and indiscriminate gunshots and tear gas canisters into Palestinian homes.
Five Israeli soldiers who refused military service in the occupied Palestinian territories have been indicted by an Israeli military court yesterday. A defendant for the five refuseniks told the judge panel that the five Israeli soldiers refused service for conscience reasons, and their draft is a contravention to the dignity and freedom of human beings. Israeli supporters of the refuseniks demonstrated and chanted slogans condemning the Israeli occupation, the arrest of their comrades, and threatened the occupation to bring it into trial in the International War Crimes Court in The Hague. One of the five refuseniks who have been indicted, Matan Kiminar, said, "The Israeli occupation army is a criminal one. We are fully aware what is going on the ground.
If our credibility will lead us to jail, we will go to jail. He also said, quote, we are being punished for saying the word occupation. So here I say it again, occupation, occupation, occupation. Matan Kiminar also said, quote, the most easy thing for an 18-year-old in this country is to get an exemption from the army through all kind of backhand tricks. Anybody can do it, and many do. We chose to go the hard way. We say that the occupation is a moral abomination which moral people cannot tolerate, and that this is the reason that we refuse to enlist. If our sincerity means that we will sit many years in prison, then we will sit many years in prison. To date, there have been over 570 Israeli soldiers and 27 Israeli pilots who refused to serve in the occupied Palestinian territories.
2 days ago, a 67-year-old Palestinian man, Jabar Mahari, from the town of Ziza in the West Bank, approached the Israeli-built apartheid wall on Palestinian land, where he was stopped by the Israeli occupation army that was guarding the wall. Jabar's house is on one side of the wall, while his farmland is on the other. On Monday, he tried to go to his farmland through the heavily guarded Israeli gate, but was denied access under the pretext of not having permission to go to his land. Jabar told the occupation soldiers that he did not need permission to go to his own farmland, and that was when the Israeli soldiers arrested him, severely beat him, and caused serious wounds to him. Jabar suffered a severe hemorrhage in his brain due to the severe beatings by the Israeli soldiers. Jabar's son Mahmoud told reporters, quote, the Israeli troops arrested my father and took him into an undisclosed location. After about 30 minutes, I was shocked when I saw his body lying on the road, bleeding severely. I rushed him to the hospital as fast as I could, unquote. Meanwhile, the Israeli Prime Minister, Ariel Sharon, has vowed to keep up building the apartheid wall. The Israeli-run state radio quoted Sharon yesterday as saying, Israel will annex over half of the West Bank in any final status settlements with the Palestinians.
In the West Bank city of Hebron, dozens of armed Jewish settlers guarded by the Israeli occupation army started attacking Palestinian vendors and breaking their shops at a marketplace. The settlers from the Jewish colony of Adaboya arrived for the second consecutive day to the nearby area and started throwing stones and beating unarmed Palestinian civilians passing through the streets, all under the eyes of the Israeli occupation army who was guarding them.
The Israeli occupation army manning a military checkpoint close to the Jewish colony of Kidumim opened fire at a taxi, killing Kamila El-Shuli, a 20-year-old. She was killed instantly. Miss El-Shuli was the mother of two and a student at the Najah University. The dead woman was en route to one of Ramallah's hospitals to treat her four-month infant boy. Last Thursday, six Palestinians were killed and 18 were wounded, including six children and two women, mostly with serious conditions, when the Israeli occupation army invaded Rafah city in the Gaza Strip. When the invading forces opened fire indiscriminately, five houses were also completely destroyed in the invasion. By the way, for the past 10 straight weeks, there have been no Palestinian attacks inside Israel, but Israeli attacks against Palestinians have not stopped for a single day. In the last 2 weeks alone, Israel has killed 21 Palestinians and injured 55 others.
And again, while the entire world was busy following the details of Saddam Hussein's arrest 2 days ago, the Israeli occupation forces fully demolished 18 Palestinian houses and 13 others were partially damaged in Khan Yunis refugee camp south of the Gaza Strip. A large Israeli military convoy and five D-9 Caterpillar bulldozers made in the USA invaded Khan Yunis under aerial support of Apache helicopters made in the USA, opened gunfire towards the civilian houses, making it easy for the Israeli bulldozers to launch its demolishing terrorist acts on the Palestinian houses. 40 families were made homeless out in the open air in severe cold and heavy rain conditions.
Several Israeli newspapers reported that the Israeli military had developed a plan to assassinate Iraqi President Saddam Hussein after the first Gulf War in 1991. Israeli forces had planned to kill Saddam as he attended the funeral of his father-in-law in his hometown of Tikrit. The report said special troops would have flown secretly into Iraq, where they would attack Saddam and his entourage with a specially designed missile. However, the plan was never implemented because five special operations soldiers were killed when they were hit by a missile fired at them by mistake as they were practicing their operation.
U.S. occupation forces shot dead at least 16 Iraqis in three Iraqi towns in the past 36 hours, while three U.S. soldiers were wounded in Tikrit yesterday. The three U.S. soldiers were wounded by a roadside bomb. In the Iraqi town of Samarra, west of Baghdad, American troops killed 11 Iraqis who tried to ambush them in a series of firefights, according to a U.S. military statement. Samarra was the scene of clashes between U.S. soldiers and Iraqis last month. U.S. commanders initially claimed to have killed 54 Iraqis, but local residents and police reported that less than 10 people were killed. At least 12 other Iraqis were killed and 20 others were injured on Monday when two car bombs ripped through two police stations in Baghdad. Additionally, U.S. troops killed two Iraqis after a pro-Saddam demonstration that had about 750 people in it.
Former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark expressed his readiness on Sunday to act as defense lawyer for the former Iraqi President Saddam Hussein. Clark, currently in Cairo attending an international anti-occupation conference, stressed that Saddam, however brutal, should be given a fair, objective, and impartial trial. Ramsey Clark, who opposed the U.S.-led invasion and occupation of Iraq, said, quote, "Saddam must be domestically prosecuted first, and if this fails, he should be referred to an international court," unquote. He doubted, however, that the ousted Iraqi president would be given such a fair trial. Clark stated that neither the U.S. installed interim governing council nor the occupation forces are eligible to try Saddam. He said, quote, "The Iraqi governing council does not represent Iraq. It is Bush's council. Occupation of Iraq is in itself an international crime and runs counter to common decency and moral integrity," unquote.
The International Atomic Energy Agency's chief asked Israel to give up its secret arsenal of nuclear weapons to head off an arms race in the Middle East, asserting that nukes would not bring the much-hoped-for security to Israel. Mohammed al-Baradei pressed Israel to follow in the footsteps of countries that voluntarily took the initiative of destroying their nukes under IAEA supervision, citing South Africa as a classic example. He said, quote, "We operate under the assumption that Israel has nuclear arms. Israel has never denied this," unquote. The chief of the UN nuclear watchdog also encouraged Israel to sign up to the non-proliferation treaty. He said, quote, "I am not happy with the status quo because I see a lot of frustration in the Middle East due to Israel sitting on nuclear weapons or nuclear weapons capability, while others in the Middle East are committed to the non-proliferation treaty," unquote. Israel, India, and Pakistan are the only countries with nuclear facilities that have not signed the non-proliferation treaty, which was initiated in 1968 to stop the spread of nuclear weapons through inspections and sanctions. The Los Angeles Times reported last October that Israel's nuclear arsenal has grown from an estimated 30 nuclear bombs in 1967 to 400 nuclear and thermonuclear weapons. The CIA and the Pentagon said in one of their reports released last year that Israel now has between 200 and 400 enhanced radiation and hydrogen weapons. The Washington Post also revealed last October that Israel has succeeded in modifying U.S.-made cruise missiles capable of carrying nuclear warheads to be launched from submarines. It is worth mentioning here that U.S. intelligence agencies routinely omit Israel from semi-annual reports to Congress identifying countries developing weapons of mass destruction to protect the country from any economic or military sanctions.
And finally, rounding out the news tonight, a new nationwide poll of 1,200 American adults conducted early this year by the Boston-based research firm, the Martilla Communications Group, on behalf of the Jewish group, the Anti-Defamation League, has revealed that more than 40% of the American people believe that Israel is a threat to world peace. The Anti-Defamation League said that its survey showed that 43% of Americans believe Israel is a threat to world peace. About 2 months ago or so, we reported here on Arab Voices that a survey conducted for the European Union revealed that 59% of Europeans felt Israel was the greatest threat to world peace.
We will take a short break now, and when we come back, we will talk with Kathleen Christison, a freelance writer who worked as a political analyst with the CIA for 16 years. We will discuss with her the latest developments in the Middle East and the U.S. policy towards it. We will also take your calls live, so please make a note of the phone number. It is 713-526-5738. That's 713-526-KPFT. Welcome back to the Arab Voices on KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston, 89.5 FM in Galveston, and kpft.org on the World Wide Web. This is Saeed, producer and host of Arab Voices, along with my co-host Mark. With us now live over the phone from Santa Fe, New Mexico, is Kathleen Christensen. Kathleen worked as a political analyst with the CIA for 16 years, dealing with the Middle East for 8 years. Since resigning from the CIA in 1979, she has been a freelance writer dealing with the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. She has published articles and book reviews in several Middle East journals, particularly the Journal of Palestine Studies. She contributed articles to the Encyclopedia of the Modern Middle East and the Encyclopedia of the Palestinians. The Christian Science Monitor ran her four-part series on Palestinian Americans based on approximately 50 interviews conducted around the country. Kathleen is the author of the highly recommended Perceptions of Palestine, a definitive overview of the U.S. foreign policy on the Palestinian issue, and The Wand of Dispossession. She has written numerous book reviews for newspapers throughout the country and has been a member of the National Book Critics Circle since 1986. Kathleen, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good evening. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And I'm going to ask you a question first before we get into the Palestinian-Israeli issue, and that's where you seem have spent a lot of time, about the Iraqi situation and your view of the capture of Saddam Hussein.
Well, I suppose we all have to be, I think it's a good thing that he was captured. He was not a good leader, for the Iraqi people, and a dictator and ruthless and all that sort of stuff. But I don't think that it's going to make much of a difference in the situation in Iraq. I think most of the guerrilla activity and attacks on U.S. forces are done not because of Saddam Hussein, but because Iraqis are nationalists and they want the United States out. They want any occupying power out of the country, and I think as long as the U.S. military is there and the U.S. is controlling the Iraqi Governing Council and so on, I think we're going to face these guerrilla attacks, whether Saddam Hussein is in jail or not. So in the long run, I don't think it makes much of a difference in the situation.
And that's precisely here, actually, why in our news segment, we concentrated on what is really happening on the ground.
Exactly.
We talked about Iraqis, we talked about what's happening in Palestine, because we know he was captured, and we all agree that he was a dictator, not good for the Iraqis, or anybody else, really.
Uh-huh.
And, but what is happening in Iraq is not Saddam Hussein, it is for the, right now, the U.S. occupation of Iraq to end.
That's
and
right.
Let the Iraqis govern themselves and run their daily life on their own.
Yeah.
There have been many reports on the TV that predicted that the anti-American or the resistance in Iraq is going to increase just based on people did not want to fight the Americans before because they did not want to be associated with Saddam Hussein. But now it's, hey, Saddam is gone. What are the Americans are doing in our country?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And as you made clear, what Israel is doing to the Palestinians goes on no matter what happens. And this has been this sort of hype about Saddam's capture has further obscured any coverage of what the Israelis are doing to the Palestinians. So.
Yes, and before I go in more details with that, I read the report that you tried to visit Iraq when it was under the former government and with the Voices in the Wilderness, but they denied visa to you because you've worked with the CIA, correct?
Yeah, that's our understanding. We had applied to go with Voices in the Wilderness, which, as you know, is a peace organization founded by Kathy Kelly, that in the mid-1990s that had was primarily protesting the sanctions in Iraq, and they had sent many delegations, peace delegations, to go to Iraq and sort of witness what has what had been going on, what had been happening to the Iraqi people under sanctions, visiting hospitals and visiting families whose, you know, who had lost children, children who had become ill with things like leukemia and so on because of depleted uranium, our use of depleted uranium in the first Gulf War, and the lack of medical supplies because of the sanctions and so on. So it was an organization to witness, as I said, what was happening to the Iraqi people, and try to spread the word back here in the United States about what was happening under sanctions. And we applied to go early this year in January, and it took a long time, and by the time we were finally accepted by Voices in the Wilderness, it was we actually left the country on March 5th. Actually, it was even a couple of days later than that. I think we got to Amman, Jordan, on March 8th. And, of course, this was only, as it turned out, 10 days or 12 days before the war started. And although Voices in the Wilderness had been assured by the Iraqi government that my husband and I would get visas, even though we had worked for the CIA in the past, we actually left the CIA 25 years ago, I think everybody was, as it got closer and closer to the war, and everybody knew it was coming, the Iraqi government and Voices in the Wilderness itself, got more and more nervous, and they probably didn't want to have to worry about whether CIA people might be whether we had good credentials or might still be associated with the CIA. Anyway, they were nervous, and we did not get our visas. So since we were in the Middle East, my husband and I, the rest of our peace team, eight other people did get in, and they spent the next month and throughout the war there. My husband and I went to the West Bank instead, so it was not a wasted trip at all. We decided we would be witnesses for the Palestinian people, and we visited Jenin and saw the terrible devastation there. This was, at this point, a year after the Israelis had really destroyed the refugee camp there. And we visited Nablus and some other West Bank cities, went through checkpoints, and then came home and wrote a lot of articles about what the Palestinians were enduring. So that was a long story. I'm sorry.
Oh, no, that's perfectly fine. I'd love to know more details about it, especially from, and if you could help us and our listeners, you've worked for a long, long time with the CIA. Tell us more about that and how you started all of a sudden, and I don't know if that was a shift of your view, but it's unusual for maybe, or at least the public, that somebody is working with the CIA to just start writing about the Palestinians and talking about the Israeli atrocities there, especially, and I'm going to mention it later on tonight, about a new report that was just released by the CIA basically saying that forget any peace agreement for 20 more years.
I've heard about that. I haven't read it yet, yeah.
How did you become so involved and...
Well, I started. Both my husband and I worked at the CIA. He for longer than I, and in a higher position. And he retired in January 1979, almost exactly 25 years ago. And I wasn't old enough to retire quite, but I quit at the same time that he did. And I had worked initially in Vietnam. Both of us were analysts rather than spies. We were on the CIA is divided into. Basically into an analytical half and an operational half. And the operational half are the people who go overseas and gather information from agents in various countries. Analysts usually sit at desks and analyze all of the information that comes in from human sources and from intercepted communications and satellite photography and so on. So that's what we did, my husband and I. We did have occasional overseas tours, but most of our work was done, at a desk in Washington. And I had started to work on the Middle East in 1971 after having worked on Vietnam for quite a number of years. And, it was then, 71, so I worked on it for about 8 years inside the CIA, and I got, at the CIA, I got a much better appreciation than the average American citizen reading the media. I got a better appreciation for the Arab side and the Palestinian side of this Arab-Israeli conflict and Palestinian-Israeli conflict. But I must say I learned a lot more about the background, about what happened to the Palestinians in 1948 and in 1967 and so on, after I left the agency and continued my interest in the issue and read a lot of history and current analytical books on the current situation and so on. And I just, as I said, continued my interest. And I think both my husband and I neither one of us was very right-wing or terribly conservative when we worked at the CIA, but we have become much more liberal, much more progressive since leaving the agency, because we've sort of seen another half of the world. I should say that the analysts in the CIA tend to be more liberal to begin with than the operators. So we started out with a little bit of a more open-minded perspective, even when we were working in the agency, than the CIA generally has a reputation for. But after moving to New Mexico, far away from Washington, we formed a broader perspective than we had in the CIA, and have become, I must say, very, very anti-Bush administration since George W. Bush has come into office. We've been very, very much opposed to Bush administration policy, promoting U.S. global hegemony, much greater support by this administration for Israel than I think any previous administration, and those sorts of things we have written on them, and we sort of gained a reputation for being progressive. To make a long story short, our views have evolved over the years, but we have come a long way from our thinking when we actually worked at the CIA.
And the books, the couple of books that you have authored and published, Perceptions of Palestine and the second one, The Wand of the Dispositions,
uh-huh.
Those were based on those information, what you've observed, and also your visits to the occupied territories?
Less based on visits to the occupied territories than on, actually there are two very different books. One of them, The Perceptions of Palestine, is a history and analysis of how U.S. policy has been made on the Palestinian issue from the first policymaker who ever made a policy decision, Woodrow Wilson, back 80 years ago, I guess, or so. more than 80 years. That's a more sort of academic book and traces U.S. Policy through actually from the middle of the 19th century when Americans first began to become conscious of Palestine, at least as a religious issue, you know, the Holy Land, and travelers started to go to the Holy Land in large numbers. And then it became a political issue with Woodrow Wilson, and so it traces every administration up through Clinton and the breakdown of the Camp David peace process and so on. And the other book, The Wound of Dispossession, is based on interviews with Palestinian Americans throughout the country. Many of them I call them Palestinian Americans because they live in America, or did when I interviewed them. Many were not American citizens and had really close ties, close continuing ties to Palestine and elsewhere in the Middle East. And this was in some ways a more emotional book, because it was Palestinians talking about their situation, their own personal stories, and what happened to the Palestinians as a nation, as a people in 48 and so on. And I did this, I could never get the book published. I started doing the interviews in the late 80s and into the first couple of years of the 1990s, then couldn't get the book published, and it sat in a drawer for a long time until I revived it in 2002 and published it with the help of a publisher here in Santa Fe. I have to say I learned an immense amount about the Palestinian situation from meeting the 120-plus Palestinians whom I interviewed. So it was quite an experience.
How did you get any support from anybody in the CIA or the government, or just complete, or even from the public outside? Or how does that affect your relations with them?
Well, no support from the CIA, and I didn't try to get support, nor did I get any opposition, but I just was never in touch with them, haven't been in touch with them since I left there. On support from the public, I get, the book, the Perceptions of Palestine, both of them are small print runs. Perceptions of Palestine was published by the University of California Press. And it is university presses never become, I mean, university press books never become bestsellers by any means. And they just had a small print run. It is still in print, and it does sell, I guess, reasonably well for a university press book. The other book is also a small print run. And occasionally from my website I get a message of support. Occasionally messages of criticism also, although I must say more support than criticism. The same is true of articles my husband and I both have written together and separately, articles on the website Counterpunch, counterpunch.org, on the Middle East. I write on the Israeli-Palestinian situation, sometimes both of us do, and my husband is has a broader perspective and has written on U.S. policy and the problems with U.S. policy. And we get quite a lot of support from those articles, also some criticism, but again, more support than criticism.
So let me ask you this question then. It seems that as working as an analyst for the CIA for 16 years or so, you've had a lot of, as you mentioned, access to information, perhaps detailed information and more facts than the average American would hear or access from the mainstream media.
Yeah.
Knowing these facts and the details, is that what gave you this perception about the Palestinians, and that's when you changed your mind, or maybe just found out, hey, this is not what the mainstream media says, that basically Israel is the victim and the other party is the person, the area that assaults them?
I think I began to change my view. When I started working on the Middle East in 1971, I had no background in it, in the area at all. I had read, like most Americans, I had gotten my education, quote-unquote, in the Middle East and in the Arab-Israeli issue from reading Exodus, Leon Uris's book Exodus, which is a terrible way to learn any kind of history, I must say. But I did, while I was working at the CIA, just because I concentrated on the problem, I read more books that were available to the public. But, of course, most of the public doesn't read a lot about this issue. But also, because of working on the problem, I did have access to more information, certainly than the average American has. And then simply after I left the agency, again, as I said, simply because I concentrated on the issue, I have learned an immense amount. And nowadays with the internet, it is so easy to get access to information that is not in the mainstream media, to the kind of news that you reported at the top of your program. I also read the statement from the Israeli refusnik that you read. I read it today in an email. And so nowadays it is so easy to get information, to get access to that kind of information, if you know where to look and if you're interested. The tragedy is, the trouble is, that the New York Times reporters, the Washington Post reporters, and the mainstream media in general, ABC and the networks and so on, don't report most of this. In fact, they report almost none of it, and they certainly don't report it in any detail. So, the average American doesn't know very much.
And I want to remind our listeners of the phone number to call and ask our guest questions. That phone number is 713-526-5738. Again, 713-526-KPFT. And our guest tonight is Kathleen Christensen, who worked as a political analyst with the CIA for 16 years.
Kathleen, before we get to our questions, I have a question for you. I know the phones are going to start ringing, and I may not get a chance again.
Okay.
In fact, they're ringing now, and I have to answer them. But I wanted to ask you, how would you describe the relationship between this administration and the intelligence community? I know it's never a static one. If you could maybe answer it in terms of the Joseph Wilson, Valerie Plame incident, some background for our listeners. I'm sure they're probably all aware of it, but Joseph Wilson was an ambassador, and he was sent to investigate the whole uranium for, Saddam trying to acquire uranium from Africa, and his wife was subsequently outed, as they say, to discourage him, he thinks, and I'm inclined to agree, to discourage him and others from coming out against the administration's position. How do you characterize this administration's relationship with the CIA and other intelligence groups?
Well, I have to emphasize I'm speaking, just as an outside observer, but obviously an interested observer, since this is an area where, an agency that I used to work in. But I think you're exactly right, and Joseph Wilson is exactly right, that his wife was outed as an agent, as a CIA employee case officer, in order to discourage him from opposing the administration and putting out a story that was totally at odds with the administration's line. And I must say, I think Joseph Wilson demonstrated pretty clearly that the information that that Bush, for instance, put out in his State of the Union message about the Iraqis, Saddam Hussein supposedly trying to buy uranium, yellow cake, from Niger in Africa, Wilson demonstrated pretty clearly that was a total forgery and a total lie. And I would guess that the administration knew that it was lying when it put that story out. I think it's an odd. It seems, again, as I'm speaking, as an outside observer, but the relationship between this administration and the intelligence community is sort of a mixed bag. I have a sense that at the working level, that the administration has put a lot of pressure on analysts. There have been stories in the press, for instance, that Vice President Cheney has gone to the CIA and sort of put pressure on analysts by quizzing them about their analysis and so on, which is an unprecedented thing to do. The consumers of intelligence, usually the policymakers who consume the intelligence output and the analysis usually take what they get, and they can do whatever they want with it, but they do not, have not in the past, gone to the agency and put pressure, openly put pressure on analysts to change their analysis to suit what the administration wants. That seems to have happened at least in, during the run-up to the Iraq War. And so the, I have a sense that analysts are very unhappy with the this kind of pressure. On the at the same time, George Tenet, the director of the CIA, seems to be, I don't know how to put this diplomatically, in many ways seems to have sold his soul to the administration and has tried to accommodate what the administration wants and the kind of intelligence that the administration wants. Which is a very bad way to run the CIA, I think. So,
what do you make of the report that was released, as a matter of fact, just in the last 48 hours by the CIA, basically saying that the Middle East peace agreement is unlikely before the year 2020? I don't know if you've seen the report or not.
Yeah, I knew. I have seen. I was just reading before you, before I came on here. I was reading my email and I saw that there was this report, but I haven't had a chance to read it. You know, when you do analysis 15 years out or 17 years out, it's a very dicey thing. It's so hard, you know. So many things could happen in the next 17 years to say to change anybody's analysis that makes it an almost worthless report. I remember once years ago in the mid 1970s, I think I was supposed to look at what at the Arab-Israeli situation 10 years ahead. And I was totally wrong. I mean, anybody would be totally wrong if you try to lay out a scenario 10 years ahead in a volatile place like the Middle East. So doing it even farther ahead is even more a feckless exercise, I think. On the other hand, I am as pessimistic as they are. I don't see any certainly not in the foreseeable future any reasonable, stable and just peace solution coming out of the Israeli-Palestinian situation.
Okay, I want to give our listeners an opportunity to ask our guest questions, and that number again is 713-526-5738. Let's go to line one. You're on there.
Hi, I was. I had a question about U.S. involvement with Israel, seeing as our tax dollars, billions upon billions of our tax dollars, are poured into Israel every single year. I was wondering, what benefit is the United States getting out of this deal? Why does it continue to financially support Israel like that, financially and militarily and technically and logistically? Why? What benefit is the United States getting out of this?
I think that's a good, very good question. I think that the United States thinks that it gets a strategic benefit, some strategic benefit anyway, from Israel. I think that they think that that Israel's presence in the Middle East sort of tends to maintain the status quo, tends to control what the U.S. would think of as radical Arabs and so on. I think there is also. I don't necessarily agree with that, but I think that's has tended to be the U.S. position throughout the years. But there is also a very huge domestic political benefit to any politician in supporting Israel, and this has become more and more the case, and is very much so the case nowadays in the Bush administration. And also in the Clinton administration, it seems to be a cumulative effect. The pro-Israeli lobby is very strong and very dedicated. The American Jewish community, or at least the vocal part of the American Jewish community, has made support for Israel an election issue for every politician, every member of Congress, and certainly for George Bush, and that is one of the principal reasons that Bush, for instance, is I don't think is going to exert any pressure at all in the next year, as he's coming up to elections, on Ariel Sharon, any of the kind of pressure that it would be needed to get Israel to move toward toward peace negotiations. Not that Bush has exerted any pressure in the past, but it's going to be even less likely now, I think, in the next year. Yeah, so support for Israel is, you know, is a domestic political issue, and that is probably the main reason that we continue to pour billions of dollars into Israel.
Well, thank you for your call. We'll go to the next line right now.
Yeah, let's go to the caller on line two. KPFT, you're on there.
Yes, I was curious about how I would need to interpret something like a year or two ago when Colin Powell visited Egypt for an attempt to have the government have some coercion on the broadcasting of a film series based on the protocols of the Elders of Zion, and this type of diplomatic measure, the importance of that, and its link with anti-Semitism as a propaganda tool.
Well, I think, I guess the protocols of the Elders of Zion, I mean, I believe it was a forgery, and the program was, I don't know, probably maybe not the best produced program, or the Egyptians have certainly have a right to produce, any Egyptian has a right to produce any television program, if you agree with freedom of speech and freedom of the press and so on, which is supposed to be a primary American value. And I think it's unfortunate that it, so much was made of it in the United States, and to the point that Colin Powell goes to Egypt to try to pressure the Egyptian government to commit a very undemocratic act by trying to control and muzzle its press, which of course it probably does in any case, but the whole issue of anti-Semitism is—it's hard to describe or get a handle on or talk about in any brief way. There certainly has been a rise of things like synagogue, and not just in Egypt, in fact, not primarily in Egypt, but in Europe, synagogue bombings and attacks on individual Jews and things like that. That I guess we would, and of course the couple of synagogue bombings in Turkey, and I guess we would have to call that anti-Semitic. But I think it arises out of a political, not a hatred of Jews so much as a political opposition to Israel, because of what Israel has done, particularly in the last 3 years, to the Palestinians. And that's when it has been in the last 3 years that anti-Semitism has arisen. So I don't know. I think I'm floundering around here, but I see anything like a synagogue bombing as terrorism primarily, not as anti-Semitism primarily, and I see it as, and it is reprehensible because it is terrorism. But opposition to Israel is not anti-Semitism. Criticism of Israel's policies is not anti-Semitism. So I hope I've given you some kind of a decent answer, but I think I've flailed around a little bit, but because it's such a difficult issue.
Yeah, and we agree with you here on Arab Voices regarding the bombings of synagogues or any attacks on any civilians, that these are terrorist attacks to be condemned. But again, saying that the occupation is illegal and saying no to the occupation and saying no to the atrocities on the ground and the killings and the bombings from there of the Palestinian population is definitely not anti-Semitism.
Yeah.
Let's take another caller. We'll go to line three. KPFT, you're on there.
Yeah, I'm a Jew, and I respect very much your just announced opinion of anti-Semitism as a tool. But my question is, what are the real motives of the Israeli officials beyond their public propaganda, as you understand it and analyze it?
I think the present Israeli government, certainly, and to a great extent, all past labor governments of Israel, have intended to maintain control over the West Bank and Gaza, never to give the Palestinians enough control that they could have a truly sovereign, truly viable, and truly independent state. I don't think Ariel Sharon, he may end up, in fact, he's supposed to give a big policy speech tomorrow.
Which, by the way, he will announce in it that he's going to annex and take a big portion of the West Bank.
Yeah, I think that's right. And he may say that the Palestinians can have the little portion of land that is to be about 40%, I guess, which will be inside the wall when it is finally constructed all the way around. But that is, those will be several disconnected segments of land, totally surrounded by Israeli territory, and you cannot have a viable, independent, and truly sovereign state in that situation. I think even Ehud Barak at Camp David and his supposedly generous offer wanted to give the Palestinians, I think he was willing to give them a lot of land, that is, you know, a large proportion of the West Bank, but again in disconnected segments and in a configuration that would not have permitted them to have true independence. Again, his proposal would have left the Palestinians with territory broken up into different parts and totally surrounded by Israeli-controlled territory. I think the Israelis have always, since they captured the West Bank and Gaza in 1967, intended to maintain dominion over over the Palestinian territories. They might have allowed semi-independence or autonomy to the Palestinian people, because they don't want to have to control the Palestinian people, but they wanted to control the maximum amount of land and allow the Palestinians a minimum amount of true independence.
Just for the sake of clarity, well, first of all, I want to thank that listener who called in, and I would encourage all listeners to KPFT to call in to this show. You don't have to be Arab to get on the air, as I'm sure you've heard. But to clarify, the 40% that you mentioned, just for people to understand what that means, it's actually 40% of 22%.
Exactly.
It's not 40% of the total landmass, just so people don't get confused about that.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Okay, let's see if we can try to manage to take the last call and on line one, and we can ask you to please make it a very short question. You're on the air. Go ahead, please.
The CIA is now, or at least the special forces, whether it's CIA or by Pentagon, they are into actually conducting their own act of terrorism and assassination in Iraq right now, and they're hitting various cities, towns, and yet the media is not really reporting these atrocities, and they're bringing in, you know, sledgehammers, explosives, blowing up homes, and you see the children in the background all weeping, crying. Mm-hmm. And yet the neocons, the CIA, and the Pentagon are
okay,
really getting away with it.
Caller, I'm going to have to interrupt you because we have 1 minute left in the show. Yeah. We have to give our guest time to respond.
And Kathleen, please try to answer
I think the caller is exactly right about what is happening. There has been, fortunately, some press coverage. Seymour Hersh wrote quite a good article in the last week's issue of the New Yorker magazine, and there was a front page story a few days before, or a week or so before that, on these tactics. And what has happened is that the Americans are getting training, being trained by the Israelis in the tactics that the Israelis have been using in the occupation in the West Bank and Gaza, occupied Palestinian territories, the home demolitions, targeted assassinations, and so on. And this is really appalling. And although it has had a little bit of press coverage and in, you know, mainstream publications, it has not had nearly enough press coverage. This should be splashed all over the headlines and all over the television, because
yes,
it is really outrageous.
Okay, we're out of time. I want to thank Kathleen Christison, our guest tonight, who has worked with the CIA for 16 years. Thank you so much for sharing with us your knowledge and experience.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you.